This is Waris Hussein, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Yeah?
I'm Ryan Dombrowski.
I'm the Ninja Fat Man from Doom Ninja Podcast,
a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Whitten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
Charles Martin.
I got their first album, The Salty Butter.
And Haley Malley.
I used to be right next to a train track.
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers. We do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but don't worry. If we look too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 313 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've learned that the afterlife isn't the Nether Sphere, it's Norway. And that the only things lurking dark water aren't just Cybermen, they're sentient amphibians. Really gives you a kind of a unexpected sense of peace, doesn't it? I'm Charles.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Keir. This week, Ed Heim and Jamie Childs create a modern dark fairy tale with just the right use and balance of terror, absurdity, humor, and a lot of heart in the rather complex but rather quick-paced It Takes You Away. I wanted to check in with each of you to sort of get your opinion of the what seems to be the kind of the predominant phrase used for early reviews for this episode, having to do with that whole fairy tale format. And how it works on both a literal and on a rather implied level. On your first blush, first pass through the story, did either of you sort of see that recurring, or was there something else that was catching the majority of your interest?
You know, for me, it wasn't until afterwards, like looking back on it, that I kind of realized, oh, that really was kind of a fairy tale style thing. It was, while it was going on, it was a lot of different stuff going on that I was trying to keep track of, and you know, trying to figure out what the sound was and what's going on here and now how's that. It kept me engaged enough that it wasn't until afterwards that I was able to like look at it broad strokes and say, oh, it was a modern day fairy tale kind of thing.
Okay,
I definitely see the fairy tale aspects of it. I am a huge fan of Northern Europe, and when Graham said, you know, that they were looking at Norway, if he and Grace had carried on, that was just, oh, yes, I already love this episode. And then, the thing people forget about fairy tales is a lot of them have super dark contexts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And this really nicely touched on that. What I was thinking as I was watching it, though, I have to say, without being too spoilery, is I think I happen to have known Douglas Adams back in the day, and I think he would have loved this, loved it.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there are a lot of aspects of this particular story that that I was pleased throughout the viewing to see from a thematic and from a construct perspective, how this story reminded me of the way that a lot of classic and even some modern Who stories that I particularly enjoyed were built, both as far as their skeletal storytelling structure and just some aspects of going back and you know, giving the occasional nod or reminding us that there, you know, as we've said from right prior to when this series began, that you, viewer, whoever you are going to get things that either make sense to you, don't make sense to you and you don't care to seek any deeper through it, or don't make sense to you and you want to find out why it has some significance so you can do your research, and congratulations, here's the rest of Doctor Who. This story did exactly that. I mean, we had everything from the subtle to the obvious, like the reverse the polarity line that just is there for everyone's benefit.
And came out of such left field. Loved the way that was done.
It was, now, granted, it gave Yaz one of her, I think, sadly, few lines in this story. I felt she was underutilized, but not... not painfully so.
Back to being underutilized, yes.
Now, so as far as reminders or feelings, reminiscence to past stories, classic and new, where did you see some parallels being drawn?
It was part of the thing that, we've got the delayed reveal of the antagonist, where it's a lot of mystery. It's, it must be this. Oh, it must be that. No, here's a red herring and here's a, that screamed classic Who to me. Mm-hmm. And granted, since it's all in one episode, we're not waiting until, part three to find out, but it was very late in the game that it really came to fruition. That's like, this is who we're working against. This is what we're, the flesh moths or I can't even remember his name. The
ribbons,
the weird
ribbons,
yes.
Ribbons,
ribbons, like, of the seven stomachs.
Yes, it's like a lot of things. It's like, this is going to be the big bad. Oh no, okay, maybe not. Oh, this is going to be the thing. No, it's going, and that is how they ran a lot of classic Who stories, and I think that it worked really well in this instance.
Yeah, I did.
This reminded me a lot of actually the Mind Robber. Because we kept getting, because of exactly what Jay was talking about. We kept going, over here. And the way the story went in different directions, there was a monster that was not a monster. There was another monster that wasn't really the monster. Mm-hmm. And then there was, what was the actual monster?
Right.
What? Yeah.
Nope.
Actually, if you ask me, the dad was the actual monster, but that's a whole other discussion.
Which we will definitely get to.
Which we'll get into.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because when it comes to something like the Mind Robber, or when we're dealing with a story where the anticipated adversary proves to be the far, far lesser of any evils, if evil at all, and then Jay, you're bringing up the rather, I'm not going to say forgettable, but not necessarily memorable ribbons. Reminds me of something where I kept getting the feeling that there was more to the story that was the intended tale, and that ribbons was supposed to be far into the periphery. Something like, one of a glorified henchman in an earlier classic story where you'd only see them in episode 3 out of 6. But it was just occupying too much of the screen time. In fact, the entire anti-zone to me felt like it was occupying too much of the screen time, as if there was supposed to be something more there. And I will give all the credit in the world to Stephen Shapansky over at RFS, who found a tweet that he had bookmarked quite some time ago where it was a shot of the cast posing with a villain that was going to be seen supposedly in this episode.
Well, a monster, yeah. I'm not sure if it was going to be the villain, but yes. Another resident of the anti-zone, apparently.
Yeah, a 7-foot creepy-looking, vacuum-mouthed thing.
Giant anteater.
I'm sure it was totally benevolent, yeah, but was somehow left out, which just leads me to believe that there must have been huge swaths of this story either completely edited or left on the cutting room floor, which kind of explains why a lot of people said that the tonality of the story felt a little jumpy.
Either they had to cut that part out for time, or they just decided that this feature didn't work or was extraneous to the story. That does sometimes happen.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, Ribbons, while an interesting character, I initially thought they were reusing a variation of the Tim Shaw costume with no teeth in it. It's a passing resemblance.
Yeah.
But I actually liked the character quite a bit. You know, the barterer. We've run into those before.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And he was another in that tradition. The space moths, I was that a substitute? Was that a last minute substitution?
That's the thing I'm thinking of. It might have been that the weird anteater thing that we were talking about, like, it may have been that it's just, okay, this isn't working for the story. Quick, let's throw something else in there that, you know, can take its place. And that, because it did, it felt like the moths were
CGI thing.
Like,
and
yeah,
and maybe some of those lines were ADR, you know, dubbed in later to accommodate this change of character. Or perhaps it was just, in fact, it wouldn't have surprised me if they'd run across that character that were the one that doesn't have a name, and so we can't really tell you who it was, but this tall anteater might have actually been a benevolent character, might have helped them through.
Possibly.
Who knows?
Which would have, I think, worked just as well. I would have seen the antizone utilized as something that was a maybe a physically dangerous crossing. Mm-hmm. To get from portal door A to portal door B, but not something where you had to spend more than enough time to recognize, okay, that maybe there's it's a dangerous toxic atmosphere or something of that nature that made it a rush, which would have helped me with one of my other concerns, which I think we all kind of share this concern, which has to do with Hannah's father. Again, we'll get to that momentarily.
We'll get to that, but before I do, I want to say that all of the anti-zone sequences, you know, we were in Norway and then suddenly we're in a Henson film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was picking up on a lot of Dark Crystal.
Yeah, and if Giant Anteater had been there, that would have been the icing on the cake, and perhaps that's why he's not in there.
Well, you know, they blew the budget on the frog, but we'll get to the frog too. all right. So as far as the whole idea of using this, there was a lot. There were a lot of really interesting concepts jammed into the story. But I would say, on the whole, I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed how quirky and experimental and off-putting and goofy at times when it really didn't have any right to be, but throwing serious barbs at you at times when you were supposed to be enjoying yourself. That was very reminiscent of some really well-penned classic stories and modern stories as well. But Charles, I'm really glad that you brought up Adams, because that idea of diffusing the serious situations with some very, very offbeat humor.
Yeah, very absurdist moments, yeah.
Or,
in fact, I'm wondering if Ed Himes isn't just a pseudonym for Neil Gaiman, because this reminded me so much of his stuff.
I think the jokes would have been a little sharper.
fair dues.
But also the aspect of saying, you know what, I'm going to throw in some pseudoscience here that is absolutely off kilter bonkers, but you're going to accept it because we're all going to buy into it 110%.
Yeah.
So we're going to throw things at you, you know, like the doctor having seven grandmothers and this whole idea of creation having a lonely bowling partner and whatnot, you know, that you're just going to look at and say, in any other context, I would have just pulled the e-brake on this and said, that's it. I'm out. I made it 9 episodes. I can't do this.
This is a story that only Doctor Who could have told.
Yeah.
And with any sort of credibility whatsoever.
But I think it did it exceptionally well. I really enjoyed a large swath of this story in general. Jake, as far as just the I know a lot of this having to do with, there was a huge emotional pull throughout. A lot of people reacted very, well, I should say, all right, I'll say, one huge chunk of viewers reacted in a very connected, gutting sense. You know, this was one of those, oh great, I spent another Sunday evening crying my eyes out kind of thing. Another chunk of people had an emotional reaction to it and said, I can't believe they're trying to do this again when instead of just moving a story along, they're trying to continually hit us in the heartstrings, but this one didn't connect with me. I saw what they were trying to do, but I didn't feel it. Yeah. And
there was a third chunk of people who just said, is Ed Himes on mushrooms? Because this is very trippy.
Yes.
And yeah, psychedelic was the word I heard a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what was your first walk away from this?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I felt like it was, excuse me, it hit the points that it needed to. You did feel for the characters, whether you knew it was coming or not, you understood what was being portrayed, and you did feel it. It was just one of those that, you know, it may be obvious that they're trying to get you to empathize with the characters, but that moment when Hannah's sitting there terrified, or when Graham looks back at not Grace with that, you know, that heartbreaking look on his face, you can't help but feel what they're feeling, whether you want to or not.
Right. Yeah.
Superb cast all around.
This was another one of those Bradley Walsh performances that really has me surprised that he pursued the particular aspect of entertainment that he did, as far as going for the showman kind of comedic performer, because he had a particular read on that sequence that I personally wouldn't have chosen. I mean, if someone were to, you know, point the camera at me and say, okay, here's your lines, get a couple of reads through it, great, all right, let's take. I would not have pulled it back as much as he did. He actually played the emotional reserve exceptionally well, which had me genuinely surprised and engaged through the scene. But
it's a very northern behavior.
Okay.
That's a very northern behavior. You're very quick to be happy and to share a laugh, and you become much more reserved when things aren't going so well. And in fact, that's how you can sort of tell with a northerner.
Mm-hmm.
They get quiet.
Oh, that's when you worry. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, that whole sequence. So the whole idea of treating, and this is where, unfortunately, Haley not being able to join us for the recording session, did want to interject her one primary takeaway from this, and that she was justifiably upset at the fact that this was Grace's legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that her ghost is doomed to walk the earth in an effort to bring Ryan and Graham closer together, essentially.
So just because she was able to nail it so so succinctly, I actually want to read what she sent to us. And said, I liked this episode, but it hammered home what I didn't like about the premiere. Grace was killed so her death could be a plot point and to develop the relationship between Graham and Ryan. And it really does feel like that's all that we're getting from her anymore. It's like we've seen her pop up a couple times, and it is. It's what is the impetus that it provides our male characters. Her character has really not contributed anything beyond what motivation it's provided these two, either while she's on screen or just in reference.
Right.
Yeah.
And is,
on the other hand, it would have been impractical to bring her along with that crew. If you think the crew's large now, imagine another person. She like Graham is an older person, and so therefore chances are she would have gone and Graham would have been left behind.
But there's so many ways that it could have been handled better than just, oh, let's kill her off so everybody else has an excuse to go.
Right.
And that's the frustrating thing, is that it's not whether or not she should have been included on the team. It's the way that it was handled was just, it's textbook. We're just basically using her just to push these people.
Mm.
Yeah. I get this eerie feeling that, you know, this isn't the last appearance of Grace we're going to see this season, although I don't expect her next week. She'll probably turn up in the New Year's Day special. But I sort of feel like we're being set up for something larger with her.
There was one aspect of this that, especially when Haley called that out specifically, that I thought about would have been as impactful had we, let's say that Grace was an in memoriam character from the jump, and that when by the time we met Graham and Ryan, she had already passed, and they still had this rather spiky kind of, I'm not really keen with you, or I'm not terribly keen with you either kind of a relationship. And yet they still would speak so reverently about her in retrospect. Would it have even had the same effect had you never met her?
See, I would say no on that. And that's precisely why we did.
Okay. I don't know.
I think that it part of the reason why everyone feels so strongly about her is because she was such a lovable character. Mm. If all we're getting is, if all we ever got about her was how these two characters remember her, it's going to shift the dynamic a bit. But the fact that you brought in such a lovable character just so that she can, you know, just so that she can be killed off, it just doesn't seem fair. So I don't know. It's a bit, that's the problem
with life, isn't it?
Yeah.
If there's a theme to this series, that's it. Life isn't fair.
No, but screenwriting can be.
can be. But see, then that gets to be artificial. This is right. The problem. I feel like that event has was it wise for us to get to know Grace a little bit, and she made an impression fast.
Oh yeah.
Not only was it important for us to get to know her but that also gives her. She exists as Ryan's background as well as a much shorter Graham's background. But we get to, but they both of them have so much more emotional depth because of that. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like she did a lot of the telegraphing of their backstories. We still don't know very much about Graham other than he was a bus driver of his life before he met Grace.
Yeah. I have the funny feeling though that his was one where it was an existence that he sort of defines himself as having his second definition based on his illness. You know, that was the line in the sand, and he recognizes his life from that point forward because not only because of the illness but because of Grace involved in his life. So everything else prior to that, you'll probably get very little of it.
Speaking of that, we got a second reference to his low blood sugar issue.
I will speak, and I'm sure Charles, you can speak to this effect. Branson Pickle is one of the best objects you can find in a jar on the planet, and makes a damn fine sandwich.
I'm not a fan of sour foods, but I really loved his performance. He is just such a Bradley Walsh, just such a master of emotions. Mostly he tends to focus on happy emotions, but his sad stuff is so powerful. It's really this journey that he's going through with grief is, and this story is about grief. It was a really good opportunity. I was glad the moment that washing line appeared and there was somebody behind it. I knew who it was because I knew what this story was about. It was about grief. And therefore, Grace was going to turn up.
Jay, how soon did you know that you were going to see her in this particular story? Did you make it that long, or did you feel it was telegraphed a little prior?
No, it was. I think the line, like, she got here whenever you did. It like Charles said, it's kind of obvious what the theme of the story is going after, and so it's like, oh well, who's going to have the most impact? And for half a second there, I thought, oh, who does the doctor miss more than anyone? And then I realized, oh, wait, we don't need that because we have someone from this season that's,
Right.
No so old monsters.
I was like, oh, my gosh, it's Missy. No, wait, it's not. Never mind.
Who does he miss more than anyone else? The terrible Zoden, clearly.
So speaking of the fact that we're dealing with the different reactions and handling of instances of grief, we get to one of the very large, very ugly elephants in the room, and that has to be Hannah's father. Now, there's a lot here that you could dive into and really get upset about on a bunch of accounts.
Yeah, but we could do the whole episode just on him.
Absolutely could. Like the fact that he still promotes a Slayer in 2018. Anyway, but
at least it wasn't Nickelback, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but their logo looks even more stupid reversed. There have been as many people I have seen who have been tearing apart his comeuppance or lack thereof. mm-hmm. versus those individuals who said, no, there should have been something called out far earlier in this than that as to why he didn't, knowing that this portal had any opportunity to be able to. So apparently he must have at least traveled across, found the other side of the mirror at some point, realized this alternate universe, somehow sussed it out in his head, gone back and built this elaborate ruse for his blind daughter to keep her, finger quotes, safe while he lived for as long as he damn well pleased in his false reality with his deceased wife. So the abandonment aspect, why didn't he take Hannah with him in the first place? Some people have floated the whole idea of maybe he wanted to live the carefree newlywed life again, which is horrific. But, you know, it's almost as if they're leaving the viewer to make that decision for themselves. Others mm-hmm. said, well, maybe he just wanted to make sure that everything was absolutely safe and that there were no hidden surprises before he went back and got her. But I don't buy into that for a damn.
Me neither.
Yeah, no.
I think at least what I got from the story was that he knew that this was an alternate universe. Just his shirt would have told you that. And so I think he knew that, and I think he also knew that that Hannah's mom wasn't really Hannah's mom. But he was dealing with a loneliness issue, very much a mirror of Graham's struggle, but handling it completely differently. In the end, and remember, Graham also had this same temptation, but in the end, Graham chose Ryan. And in the end, Hannah's dad did not choose Hannah, really.
But there's one additional layer to that, and that's the honesty factor. Mm-hmm. Graham could have chosen to stay, even saying, I am completely cognizant of the fact that this is complete a farce.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I'm comfortable here, and I'm happy here, and this universe accepts me, and I accept it, so I'll stay. So, Ryan, you've done well. Sorry you never fist-bumped me. You're on your own.
That's it.
And let it go. And he gets his closure and walks off and so forth.
Like Star Trek's The Cage, yes.
Precisely. Mm, yeah. But Hannah's father doesn't even give her the decency of saying, I'm going to be gone for certain, you know, an indeterminate amount of time. I will either come back for you or I will send someone for you or whatever. It gives no explanation and builds this lie around her.
So one of the theories that I've heard is that he didn't, like, he only went to the alternate universe one time, that was, and that this is all stuff that he set up ahead of time to keep her in the house when he needed to go and do something else. And I'm like, I don't know if that's better or worse. That's just even more horrific. That I mean, it's not, because okay, fine, the alternate universe has this supernatural pull and some, you know, some effect that makes you like addicted to it or whatever it is that you're going to explain it away with, fine. But
well, it gives you what you want most, as we saw with
right.
Oh my God, it's the mirror of Erised.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, wow.
Okay, everything just clicked home.
And now my brain's broken. Thanks.
Yep.
Mind blow.
But no, I just like Charles said though, the fact that Hannah's dad, that Eric never actually chose to go back to Hannah. Like the doctor pretty much had to trick the Solitrak in order to kick him out. I'm like, this is like a horrible human being. Like, even given all of the facts and everything like that, and he saw how it attacked his daughter, he was still going to stay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm going to rise on behalf of single dads everywhere here for a moment. In this story, you're absolutely right, Jay. He's a horrible dad. But clearly, because of her great attachment to him, he wasn't always that way. And they made reference to this in the episode. He was having a terrible time mm-hmm. coping as a single parent following the death of his wife. And
as a single father myself,
yes.
I call bull crap.
Well, I was about to say, I'm not in for a second trying to excuse how awful he was. But I'm very surprised that she took him back, Hannah took him back, quite frankly. But mm-hmm. but you know, of course Hannah is, because of her disability, is a bit dependent. So So there's that play. There's that factor in play as well. But yeah, but I've noticed as the child of divorce, I've noticed that dads sometimes handle these situations super badly, and that there's going to have to be a lot of there could be a whole nother episode about how she deals with him being back after that.
Right. I don't think that Hannah was absolutely so willing to take him back unscathed as well. I got the impression that this was something where there's still work to be done.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to deal with this on our time, because she was far more capable and far more insightful. I mean, she was the one that called him out and saying, you know, you're not well. You haven't been since mom died. You know, you're not my mom. I mean, she had this all sussed out within seconds. Mm-hmm. All in all, there's a lot to that. But as far as his just desserts or lack thereof, mm-hmm. you know, we are left with only from a visual standpoint, it was very impactful. The unspoken. The conversation of eyes between the doctor and the father, Eric was his name,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, where he sees the writing on the wall, literally sees the writing on the wall, and she looks over and says, damn, you know, with her eyes, damn right.
I think that was, it's hard to say, but there are multiple situations where people will choose to live in their own unreality rather than face reality. Mm. And this story was a bit about that too. But that moment, I in the very shorthanded time that they had left towards the end of the story there, that I hope that moment finally put the cap on, all right, yeah, I got to face up to this and be a dad.
Yeah. And I agree. It was like, you could kind of feel that punch to the gut for him, but given the lengths that he went to keep her in the house, I mean, literally creating a monster just to keep her in the house.
Yeah.
Like you needed a bit more. Had he just been like, oh, I didn't realize how long I was gone or this, that, or the other. Okay. That could pass as, penance for that. But mm-hmm. it was so much more than that, that I just can't, I can't let it go.
Yeah.
It's
yeah. No,
terrible.
I think this story was designed to leave some residual anger there because we didn't see Hannah and her father get fully reconciled. So mm-hmm. I think that was left hanging.
I think a great deal of this is probably a walk through a lot of Ed Heim's personal baggage. It's not something I'm going to dig into, but you know, if we ever get the opportunity to be able to chat with him, I got to wonder, you know, what were you tapping into for some of the themes and messages in here?
Because when we found out about the speaker in the forest, and by the way, I loved the way that Ryan found that out,
yeah.
And I loved the way he traced it back, and that I was thinking, okay, clearly somebody watched Scooby-Doo when they were a kid. mm-hmm. But that was, I mean, yeah, that was where that really put the full horror on it. Abandoning your kid for 4 days when they've got plenty of food in the freezer and there's nobody around for miles, bad. Putting a fake monster in the forest to keep you there, super bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, which brings us to the aspect that had a large number of viewers saying, wait a hot second. And that was our sentient universal frog being.
Hey, man, it could have been a billy bass. All right, count your blessings.
I will say that the way that they went through this, so there's a number of things that you have to accept in order for this scene to wash. One, you have to accept the whole concept of the sentient universe and the doctor being able to have a conversation with it at this critical point in the story.
Yeah,
that's fine. That's, hey, we've done a lot worse. And in fact, even the doctor was saying that this was an amazing opportunity, you know, and this, the stuff of children's tales from Gallifrey. And this was
Granny Five, apparently.
Yep. A wide-eyed moment. Again, something that builds upon. And this is, I got to say, this is something I absolutely love. The fact that, that writers are still willing to do 55 years into this program. And that's to say, you know what? I'm going to throw something into the storyline that isn't canon. I'm going to define something canonical here that is totally bat guano crazy. And I'm going to commit to it. I'm going to see if it works. And I personally felt that it worked.
Oh, yeah.
But so you got to accept. All right. So first of all, sentient universe conversation. Great. Sit down and talk to life, universe, and everything.
Yeah,
so,
that's like the end of the Matrix films. Remember that?
Yep. Yep.
Was absolutely. I the only one who saw that third one?
So no. I'm right with you. So that's issue one. Issue two. You have to accept the fact that it chooses to manifest itself physically as a frog, and vocally as Grace, two representations of this character that it seems to want to craft and hand this individual back over to its witnesses because it feels that it's acceptable, comfortable, it's a safe vehicle for conveying its point that I miss you. And my God, those lines, the dialogue in this exchange, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Just look at it written on the page, and it's just, it's heartbreaking. Because, and I'm going to give all the credit in the world to, there's a writer and reviewer for the AV Club, Carolyn Side, who called this out and said, this is the doctor's conversation to a potential new companion reversed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is someone
the
with
the frog
this,
was the doctor and the doctor was the companion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Saying, hop in. You know, let's see where we can go.
Frog, hop in. That's good, Kara. Very good.
I'm tired. That wasn't even intentional. I don't even
walked
want,
right into that one.
I don't even want credit for that. Keep your quarter. but it is this whole idea of, you know, you and I could be incredible together. And the doctor saying back, yeah, you can be incredible on your own. Just keep being incredible. Keep being brilliant. So right off the lines off the page read beautifully. So you have to accept that. So that's issue two you have to accept. And issue three is the fact that in light of all this, and this was the only thing, was that through it all, they went with practical puppetry instead of CG.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was enhanced with CGI, but I don't know. I don't know.
I think that was straight puppetry. Absolutely.
It'll be interesting to find out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But here's my question to the people who were complaining about this.
Okay.
Given that you have to create a sentient universe and embody it in a way that it can communicate with the doctor, what's your better option? You know, we've had conversations with God in drama many, many times. And and even in Doctor Who, quite a few times. Mm-hmm. Star Trek V comes to mind as well. So why not? This is the part in particular that I think Douglas Adams would have liked. That first of all, what Carolyn pointed out, that this was a trope of the show that we've seen 100 times turned on its head. That I liked. And the other one is, look, man, why not? You know, again, reminding me of Douglas Adams, in the Hitchhiker's books, Arthur finally meets God, and God is this confused old man who lives in a cabin and has no idea what impact his every wish and whim is having on the rest of the universe. He's incredibly isolated. Mm-hmm. That's essentially the character that we were looking at there, like the end of the Matrix as well. It's that same character again. You could say it was unoriginal, but if you saw 2001: A Space Odyssey, you'll know that this is not a new idea. And I thought it was handled just as well as it could be. If you've got a lonely sentient universe that can talk to you, it's going to be a little weird and absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. The
answers for your better plans for realizing that on a postcard, please.
Yeah. Well, or even look at something like you take things like forms of alien contact. Take Sagan's book Contact. Right. And the fact that this hyper-intelligent alien species chooses first contact by manifesting itself in a way that is going to be comfortable, acceptable, I don't even know what the term I'm looking for here. Safe? Yeah. You're looking for something that's safe. Granted, okay, is that a frog? Sure. Well, you know, I'm a frog guy. I like frogs. I'm sorry, that's a good place reference. But the whole idea of latching onto that, at least there were, for as many people that said, well, seriously, I'm talking to a frog in a chair at this point? After everything you gave me in this story, I'm talking to a frog in a chair? That for as many of those, I saw individuals who jumped forward and said, hell yeah, if anyone's going to give me a life lesson, it's going to be Kermit.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, and I keep bringing up Douglas Adams, but I'm just reminded of the hyperdimensional beings that built Deep Thought. When we saw them in our universe, they manifest as mice.
Mice, yeah.
Right? So, yeah. Look, you know, this story reminded me a lot of Adams. I have to believe that Ed Himes was aware of this too.
Not to mention, I
didn't have the slightest bit of issue with it at all.
Not to mention, though, if you're going to carry the Douglas Adams reference out to its fullest, did you check as the doctor was grabbing spoonfuls of dirt and to see whether or not any of that was labeled Slardabartfast?
Yes. Yeah, okay. That was the whole thing. I mean, I should mention, I want to call this out particularly. These, you know, I know people, a lot of fans have lined up of Chibnall scripts versus non-Chibnall scripts, and this is a non-Chibnall script, but I think the dialogue this season throughout, regardless of who the writer is, has been wonderful. And this episode in particular, really, really strong, compact, but meaningful dialogue. And funny.
Yeah.
Lots of funny. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When it goes for the punchline, when it goes for the, and they've always been subtle punchlines. There have not been any kind of moments.
True.
Yeah. They've all
that whole conversation about, well, like I said before, the way reverse polarity came up, again, turned things on its head. The whole dialogue about Doctor Who's grandmother. That just tickles me every time I even think of it.
Yeah, or the dirt eating scene. The fact that your companions are genuinely concerned about everything that's going on here, because they know anytime they probably have learned at this point, as we have, anytime the TARDIS materializes in a forest, bad stuff's going down.
Yeah, right.
But the doctor's sitting there grabbing spoonfuls and giving us a whole rundown of how far the gift shop is from where they're standing, and you know, it's
absurdist. And so that should have been your clue, gang, right there. That was a really super absurd conversation, even for the doctor.
Yeah,
that should have been your clue.
Mm. All right. So the last thing before we get down to just some kind of closing thoughts on this particular story, but as far as sequences that that bear a little additional attention, has to be Graham and Ryan's final moment and how that was handled, whether or not you saw it coming, whether or not you thought it played out the way it was going to. How did this strike you?
Definitely was one of the better ways it could have been resolved. It could have been, they could have gone really stupid, sappy, over the top. They could have just swept it under the rug. They absolutely needed to address it and give it some kind of closure without being a, you know, full on tears, I love you, man, kind of thing. And so I think that it really did do what it needed to. And I said it early on in the series that I almost hoped that when the time came that Ryan didn't actually need to call him granddad, that Graham just understood that it was implied. But I think that given the story, the way that it was, Graham needed to be able to hear it in order to shake him out of what he was going through. Like that was the thing when Ryan finally said it, Graham snapped out of it and he was like, oh, okay, that's a thing now. All right. And it brought him back to himself.
Okay.
One of the, if I have a criticism of the character arcs we've seen in this series so far, it is that Ryan's grief has been well underplayed and buried. But on the other hand, that may be the way that character deals with that. He has buried that grief for the longest time. And I think that his change of heart here in this episode two things. First of all, I think he understood that Ryan left Grace for him. And that, and of course, that was also the tip-off that that wasn't really Grace. But I think he understood that, and I think also that he has been processing his own grief all this way through, trying to subsume it. But he understands, I think, now that Graham, whether he likes it or not, is his real family. It's all the real family he's got now.
Well, and that's the other thing to consider is that Ryan has, at this point, lost three parents, at least. Like, you know, mom died, dad ran off, now Nan died. Like, he's been through this a couple
very
times.
Very unanchored,
So it's, while her dying may have shaken him to his core, he's not going to process it the same way as someone who just lost the love of their life, someone that gave them a second lease on life, as he's said it.
Exactly. You know,
we're going to see a lot more from Graham than we are from Ryan, so I'm willing to give them a pass on it.
Yeah, as far as I've been able to internalize it, I see it as Ryan is recognizing his grief for Grace by being the individual that she kept reminding him that he was capable of being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it from the sequence where he tries to get back on the bike and tries to do that. And it goes mm-hmm. forward with all of his adventures to follow. This is him saying that the only, if nothing else, he can strive or at least reach for the kind of individual that she was convinced and had reminded him of the fact that he had been all along, despite his own, you know, self-image.
And that Graham believes in him just as much as she does.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Because he knows better than anyone that if Grace says it's so, it's so.
I thought it was really deftly handled, and a really lovely moment that wasn't overplayed. And the music has been more prominent in this episode maybe than in some others, but here it was not, and that was just right.
It stepped back, but that's actually, and that was one of my notes, was that in the scene just prior, you know, talking to Kermit in the cabin, it was, well, what? How else are you going to refer to it? Anyway.
I saw God in Norway? What?
Yeah, I'm fine. You know, if that's my afterlife, yeah, Valhalla, I'm there. Akinola's score, for the first time in recent memory, really leapt forward. It was more prominent in the mix, and it was really driving a particular theme and variation home that I felt was, maybe I haven't really had the opportunity yet to go back and rewatch all of these sequentially to see whether or not he has defined new character themes as Gold did.
Not as prominently, I noticed early on that we were that occasionally the music would strike right from the first episode. We heard little variations of the old of the Doctor Who theme for when Jodi appeared, and that has been evolving when she appears, and now we've gotten, I think, its full bloom.
Right. I think what we're getting right now, and if you go back and you grab that particular sequence where she is actually bidding goodbye to the Solitract and saying, you know, where you actually get the goodbye blown kiss that everybody has seen in the trailer and wanted to know, where was that from? Why did she do that? Now we know. But I think that particular sequence that was playing is what he is laying out to be her character theme.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is phenomenal because it doesn't have the same sort of orchestra swell and poundy drums and stinging orchestra that Murray
wailing choirs.
Yeah, well, right. So, but it has its own particular power. So, I want to see. I want to go back and hear these moments because that. Right there, that 2.5 minutes or so of dialogue exchange was this series' version of one of your Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi's Sermon on the Mount kind of moments. That's what you get from Jodie. When this is the kind of the I am the doctor kind of throwdown moments, but it's not being done as
with machismo.
Precisely. It's being done as a, no, please remember who I am, because I know who I am, and that's why I have to make this decision. The gravity of all this is completely aware, and as a result, please understand, whether you agree with it or not, at least understand, this is why I have to do this. Yeah. I think that defines a lot of who this doctor is right now.
Yeah. I also have to say that the doctor, the character of the doctor, if they were offered, he said you can't travel anymore and you can't have any friends anymore and you're just going to have to live out your last days doing something odd, what would you choose? And I think any of these incarnations would have said, oh, you know, being best friends with a sentient universe would be pretty cool.
Yeah, my own little bubble universe would be great.
There was a bit in that whole, she did such a range of emotions in that scene, but that little, there was a temptation there to, she wasn't just mouthing words to try and get out. She was recognizing that, hey, this is pretty cool, but no, ultimately this isn't for me, and it's not sustainable as well, which I think she was able to convince Kermit there. But
No.
All right, Kermit. All right.
Yeah, we'll stick with Kermit.
Yeah, overdub Kermit. is that she was able to convince Kermit there. But I think that she really did wrestle with it and really did and is walking away super pleased that she was able to make friends with this and will carry that with her. It's one of those accolades that the doctor sometimes makes reference to, like when he got his doctoral Scottish, college in 1850 or whatever. It's one of those accolades that the character remembers and points to with pride.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of closing thoughts, walkaways on this one. I personally think that while it didn't maybe hit me on the same emotional level as some of the stories previous, I think as far as just a straight up, this is what any modern classic Doctor Who episode typically prepare to have something like this thrown at you. This is indicative of one of the zany, wonderful kind of stories that you could be given.
Yeah.
I mean, this is absolutely one of the, the off kilter. We've got the really horrible. We've got the absolutely stellar. We've got the run of the mill kind of, fill up the series with a bunch of these because we need some. And then we've got the what the hell was that kind of episodes. And I really do feel like this fits that last one, but it did such a great job. And while, I mean, I can nitpick this thing to death with the best of them, because there was a lot of stuff that really could have gotten some polish or gotten some more attention or something like, I feel like on the whole, this was a good episode with a good story to tell. Mm-hmm. And it was just off kilter enough to be able to drag most people in and say, you know what? I don't know what it was I just watched, but it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
On last week's episode of Gallifrey Public Radio, I hoped that maybe because of this weird title that was a signal that this was the curveball episode of the season. Ta-da! It was. I'm very happy to see it. Now, I understand very well and am respectful of the fact that curveball episodes divide fan opinion something fierce. Mm-hmm. Some people just could not get past the frog, right? Some people were, they loved different parts of the story and then hated other parts, like Eric. Some people were annoyed that Grace came back yet again. On the whole, though, I am perfectly respectful of people who have differing opinions to me about this particular story. But as I saw in one review, if you're going to call this the stupidest story in Doctor Who history, first of all, you have not watched the entire show.
No.
You haven't watched an entire season.
Yeah. Second, you really wrote before you watched this again, because you are wrong. You are just plain wrong. There is a lot here that you missed. And I'm sorry you missed it, but there's a lot here.
I think one of the most recurrent phrases from all the folks that I've chatted with and that I've read up on as far as their hot take reactions and so forth, the most common phrase I've heard after their most insightful evaluation of the episode mm-hmm. was, after sleeping on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just it. This is one of those ones where it literally, you have to unpack it. You have to process this thing because there's a lot of heady crap in here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use the term crap because some people will still think about it for a little while and say, nah, that was crap. That aspect of it.
Some people will. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, if you can't relate to some of these themes, that, you know, that's okay. Then you'll someday, 20 years from now, maybe you'll look back on it and you'll go, oh yeah, this episode had a lot more in it than I thought at the time. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
all right. It took a lot of risks.
One of my friends said something like, I've just finished watching this episode and I've got to go to bed. So I'm either going to be dreaming about it, or if I don't, then I'll be thinking about it all day tomorrow. And that is the correct reaction.
Yeah.
Yes.
In my opinion.
I will say that regardless of how much time I spend defending this episode in the future, I'm never going to be able to get past the frog who looked like it converted to worship the Great One. With all of the amazing special effects that Double Negative has brought this series, this was just so awful. And it really did pull me out of it, and it took a lot away from what should have been a fantastic scene. And the whole time I'm just staring at it like, that is the worst frog puppet I've ever seen. And I'm including Kermit. It's the most fake-looking thing. It's just it was terrible. And it had they done a better job with it, had it been all CGI, had it been a Pokemon, I don't care. I would have accepted it better than this terrible frog that... I mean, give me 20 minutes and a glue gun, and I can whip something up like that.
You now, see, don't this know. Is where this is where I have to disagree with you, youngster, because the default in Doctor Who is terrible monsters. So when I see a good monster, I'm taken out of the story.
You know, you don't know, Jay. It could have been that Ryan's frog necklace looked exactly right. like that frog.
Yes.
I get it.
She did pull it. She did pull the solo track did pull it from Grace's memories. So
precisely. Yep.
It did pull me out because it was such a terrible puppet. It really was.
I'm going to send you guys a picture of a frog that we have, a frog, not puppet, but a doll sort of thing that makes a noise that we used to have it as a motion sensor here before we finally got tired of the noise and turned it off. Mm-hmm. I'll send you guys a picture. You'll see the resemblance immediately.
Okay, great. So on that creepy note.
Let's go to the news.
All right. So we'll start with some sort of happy stuff here because it's always good to lead off with a feel good. And nothing feels better than having the doctor read you some great kid stories. This has been a tradition that has been long established with at least our modern doctors. I would love to see them go into the backtracks and get some of our classic doctors to do the same. But I don't know if it would play the same to what they try to do for viewership on this. And that has to do with getting our doctor to read our children's stories for the CBBS. Jodie's going to read a bedtime story, and what better to have Jodie read than Ada Twist Scientist? So this is a legacy that has included Tennant and Eccleston, who have had the opportunity to go and read these bedtime stories for kids. CBBS has done some amazing productions. I've been a huge fan. I admit it. I watch kids' programming probably more than I watch adult programming. So I'm not even apologetic about that because I sleep better at night as a result of it. So, but this is a phenomenal series of readings that the BBC does, where they've had everyone from Ewan McGregor to Sir Elton John reading stories mm-hmm. for kids, and always trying to make sure that they're pairing the particular title with the narrator who is going to be able to give it some inflections and some gravity that suits the nature of the tale, probably just as much for the parents as it is for the child. But yeah, so this will this is apparently going to come into kids' hands a little later this month, so right in time for the close of the year, which is par for the course, if I remember from Tenants. Tenants was the first one that really caught my attention, because I had just been on the heels of his doing the audiobooks for the How to Train Your Dragon series.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
I should point out that Bernard Cribbins used to do this sort of thing a lot.
How awesome is yeah. that?
Oh, and he was. I mean, you know, I'm talking about for years and years. I don't know if it was CBeebies or one of the other shows, but he was on. I know he was on the CBeebies from time to time doing stories as well.
Yeah. Because we needed more reasons to love Bernard Cribbins.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
it had been like 15 whole minutes since someone said wonderful about him.
When do you ever say, when do you push back from the table and say, all right, you know, I think I've had enough Bernard Cribbins at this point?
Well, some of his 45s, maybe.
All right. Okay. Charles, walk me through this next one, why I should care at all about the iPlayer where
well,
I am.
Well, before we leave this, the story that she's reading is called Ada Twist, Scientist.
Yes.
And this is apparently the third in a series of books. Just that title makes me want to go look this up because I know nothing about this series.
Please
and,
do. You will be
sounds
well
like
rewarded.
I need to know more. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The iPlayer. This thing.
So iPlayer is, if you're not watching Doctor Who on TV in the UK, your next option is iPlayer. In the UK, you can watch repeats of immediately aired shows for up to 30 days, if I remember correctly. Sadly, it's blocked outside of the UK, unless you're clever. But anyway, the point is that it has been steadily growing, and it hit an all-time record high in October. So the two lead shows, the number one show that was most watched on iPlayer in October was Killing Eve, a terrific drama. And then the second one was Jodie's first episode as Doctor Who. And these two shows in particular attracted such a large audience that it gave iPlayer its best month ever. Yay!
Which just assures them that they think they're doing something right and they're never going to offer that to the rest of us.
Right, exactly.
Okay, right. I see what you're saying. I get it. Got it. Okay. Well, as far as we were talking about the tipping back and looking back at previous doctors for a number of reasons, whether it be for reading children's stories, whether it be for how they would have handled situations like what our current doctor just dealt with in the fjords of Norway. But as far as collections of our previous doctor's works, and where we left off, which we will be getting back to in painfully just a couple of weeks' time. I wish it weren't so soon, but it's going to be back soon when we get back into our classic rewatch rotation.
Oh, I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily.
No, well, you know, it's bittersweet. Bittersweet.
Yeah.
Let's phrase
because
it that way.
Because we do want this season to go on forever, but...
Right. Yeah, we should still be getting about, you know, three more of these. But anyway.
At least we won't have to wait a year and a half this time, if rumors hold true.
But on the flip side, don't even get me started about the fact that we were told that we were supposed to be getting hour-plus long episodes. Yes. And the airtime of these things, if you look at them, are hovering around like 49, 52, 54 minutes. Hello. But anyway.
Hello.
So, back when stories were long and drawn out.
Multiple parts with yes. cliffhangers, you kids of today.
Precisely. Season 18 will be handed over to us proper. Now, I'm glad you're going to talk about this, Charles, because I'm curious about the fact that I have news information about a slightly senior yeah. successor. Season
yeah,
on the way.
Yeah, successor season. So season 18, for those of you who are not as familiar with the classic series as you should be, is Tom Baker's last year.
He left?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Spoiler.
Crap.
this was the cap of his 7-year run. 7 years, you kids. Anyway, it was the cap of his run. It had just, and it's really a great timing on this because it also had one of the largest TARDIS crews around at the time because we had Nyssa and Tegan and Adric. Okay, maybe they're not Ryan, Graham, and Yaz, but hey, come on, just go with me on this. But the incredibly magnetic of performance of Tom Baker was even more riveting to watch at when you could see that the actor knew that he was going. And it really changed the Doctor's whole demeanor. I feel like it gave him a lot of more depth. You know, he was getting a little too jokey, a little too happy-go-lucky in 16 and 17, partially because Douglas Adams was script editing part of that. But also, this one brought in a much more serious tone, harder science, not hard science, but harder science, and some fantastic stories. So this box set, in addition to containing all these great stories like Legopolis and State of Decay and Full Circle and Warrior's Gate, which, again, we just had a curveball episode. Wait till you see Warrior's Gate. That's all I got to say. Mm. There is a ton of features and bonuses and documentaries, more Panopticon footage of Tom Baker, Matthew Sweet interviewing Tom and Lala and Rachel Davies and so many others. Matthew Waterhouse has a prominent role in this box set. I cannot wait. I should also mention my buddy Mark Harris has remastered the sound on all of this, and it sounds astonishing. So.
Was he responsible for what they were doing with the surround sound mix for Warrior's Gate specifically? Is that his craft work?
Yeah. He basically, if it involves Doctor Who sound that needs patching up, that's him.
Cool. All right. Yeah. So it's definitely something to look and listen
for. I almost forgot to mention the best part. In addition to all this, the Canine and Company episode is in this box.
This is what you consider the best part. Okay.
Yes.
So for folks who are wondering exactly where Charles stands on the
Canine.
Yep. Yep. Wait. Let me pull the camera in real close, just as you do that, because that's what you do. Right.
Best theme song ever. Also, any if I can get more Liz Sladen in my life, I will.
Yes. Well, that's true. That is absolutely true. On the flip side of this, I'm going to change our sequence around here a little bit, is that we also have sort of right on the heels of that, or maybe kind of happening synonymously, is the preparation for the forthcoming Blu-ray release for season 19.
Yeah.
Being our fifth Doctor.
Peter Davison's first year.
Right. So these are all kind of slated to drop. Well, they've been kind of goofing around with the times a bit. You know, they never quite get into our hands exactly when we think they're going to be. This is also the one where we had gotten the quick little video segment the safety video,
yeah,
which was brilliant,
a delight.
But this is apparently going to be in our hands in December, whereas we'll get season 18 in February?
It's very timey-wimey and frustrating for those of us who want to buy all of this stuff for Christmas. But hey, at least we're going to get, apparently we're going to get season 19 in time for Christmas, maybe.
Right. But this one comes along with a little bit of additional baggage. And apparently, for those individuals who are in the know and have gotten sort of, I don't know if you consider it to be screener copies, what do you call it when it's a Blu-ray release and you get the additional features first?
Screeners, usually for review or award consideration.
All right, so still considered screeners. We have an interview with Peter Davison where apparently he discusses the fact that he was quite content to leave the series when he did by looking at what happened with the program in retrospect.
Well, he was very aware of it at the time, I think. And he has said variations of this, not quite so bluntly before. But the famous story is that he took Pat Troughton's advice, which is stick around for three seasons, but don't do any more because it'll hurt your career. And Pat appears to have been right about that as well, because Peter went on to a very illustrious career in all kinds of other shows. Doing Doctor Who did not typecast him at all.
Right.
But you could see it. We could all see it that the BBC was neglecting the show, that they were cutting the budget, that they were moving it around in the time schedules. And this just got an order of magnitude worse when Colin came in.
Right.
Not because of Colin.
Correct. Thank you. Yeah. Absolutely clarify that. This had nothing to do with resting on the multicolored shoulders of Colin Baker. This had to do with the fact that he was the individual who was within the crosshairs because he was within the camera lens at the time.
Yeah.
And it didn't even fall upon anything to follow Colin as well. You get into Sylvester's and so much of this conversations with Andrew Cardmill or things of that mm-hmm. sort, where they're saying, you know, what they were working with and the fact that they kept feeling hogtied with a lot of the things they wanted to move forward with the storyline because the BBC was not even paying it the attention or the time of day.
Well, they kept cutting the budget, moving it around. I mean, they were deliberately trying to lose the audience because, and let's bring him up while we can, Michael Grade came in there going, I don't like this show. I don't like what you're doing with it. And there was some, the way Peter paints it, first of all, is that Colin is the victim of these issues, not the cause of them. Let's make mm-hmm. that clear.
And he's valid.
But the other, I'm not sure whether he means it as a criticism or not, because I know Peter liked John Nathan Turner a great deal as a person, but he seems to hold the view that another factor in this was that the BBC didn't want John Nathan Turner producing anymore, but they also couldn't find anybody to replace him. So he wouldn't leave. So that was their punishment, was cut the budget, cut the number of stories, move it around, lose the audience, and it worked. It took them longer than they thought, but it worked.
Right. I will say, though, in defense, because, I'm a massive fan of the 6th and 7th Doctor eras, that you are not going to be found wanting for compelling stories.
Oh, no.
You just might have to squint a little bit from time to time. That's all.
Yeah, you could, especially with the Cartmell era, but I think also in the Colin Baker era, you could see they were going for much more than they were able to accomplish on the budget that they had.
Mm.
And I can remember Gary Downey in particular saying, who was production manager on the Sylvester McCoy years, I could remember him saying so much, if we just had a few more days of rehearsal, if we just had a few more days of location, these all these stories would be better than they are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing that you can't get away from is the conversation about the current season and the... Well, all right. Are we going to call it divisiveness? Or are we just going to call it back to our favorite theme album of the year, The Salty Butthurts, and the fact that
that was my favorite album.
Yeah, and the fact that they're still trying to find reasons to say, yeah, well, I know it's doing well in the viewership and all, but that's just because everybody's just all sheeple, and they clearly don't know what they're watching. And they're being fooled into taking some sort of social justice warrior agenda crammed down their throats, and they're just too...
Otherwise stated as, my initial predictions that this would flop were wrong, so I'm not going to change from that position. I'm just going to move the goalposts.
Right, which is why I still love seeing tweets from people like just over this past weekend saying, that's it, a frog on a chair, I'm out of the show, I'm done watching. You made it 9 episodes!
Yeah.
You waited until now to tap out? Oh, please. This is like the 6-year-old standing in the doorway. I'm going.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. No, I'm going now. So yeah. Go.
All right. See ya. The other one I love, and I see this every single news story, is like, ah, well, here we go. Finally, Jody is acting like the Doctor.
So what was she acting like before?
I don't know.
All right. So they, as a result of a conversation with the Radio Times, Mandip Gill and Tosin Cole are obviously going to be asked all kinds of things about the nature of the impact of this particular series and a lot of the themes and messages that it's been bringing to the forefront to massive success. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But they were posed with the conversation of saying, okay, there's been this overly PC thread going around and just saying, you guys, can you just tell us a single story without trying to push some sort of agenda about telling us how...
for those people, I think this one might, well, it won't satisfy them. Nothing does. But this one did not have such a beat you over the head social message, I guess. But again, what show have you been watching up to this point? Because it wasn't Doctor Who.
Right. I particularly love Mandeep's response on this about the whole idea of saying that something can be too politically correct. And that's that the phrasing of your argument in the first place completely negates any credibility because you're telling me that I am too correct.
Yeah. What? I understand that phrase. They're using that phrase as shorthand for something that it does not actually mean, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is, and let me head off the people that this is the ratings flop people as well right away, because the overnights on this one were a bit down from last week. But I just want to point out that all the British shows were down this week, all of them. Why? Well, maybe because it's Christmas buying season, you think?
Yeah, look at the calendar.
Maybe Black Friday played a role in that, you think? The point that you really should be paying attention to is this. How much of the TV viewing audience did Doctor Who capture this week? Right now, with just the overnights, it's 25% of all viewers. That's fantastic. It's actually last, the Kerblam got ninth place in the top 10, still in the top 10. This one looks like it's going to be fourth or fifth when the final ratings get.
That's the power of Norway. Yeah. That's the power of Norway. I'm telling you.
Well, to be fair, in the UK, there are some very popular Norwegian shows that have been imported. So that it's not a factor. Let's put it that way.
Okay. All right. Well, there you have it. That's our rundown for the week.
Yeah. So next week, we'll be coming back with the Series 11 finale. I can't believe we're already done.
I can't believe we're going to make Jay pronounce this.
You're gonna try. So, the Battle of Randskor Avkolos.
Very well done. So, it sounds like a mixture of Norwegian and Klingon, but hey, you did a good job.
Yeah,
we'll see what happens. No idea, but
But let me just say, I am really pleased with the fact that our trailers for next week have been so brief.
Yes. Yeah.
It gives you really nothing to go on.
Well, because you have to watch them two or three times searching in vain for any clues.
And even then, you're just like, I got nothing.
I got nothing.
All I know is we're off planet. And the fact that, you know, we're still not using this beautifully redesigned TARDIS interior that has been essentially forgotten for 9 episodes.
Very little of it. Yeah, it reminds me of the Troughton years. Very little, or Sylvester McCoy's year, when very little of the TARDIS was actually ever seen.
Yeah, more's the pity. Well,
all right. Well, this has been episode 313 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you know, all of this audio equipment that I've got on my desk right now, I've been paying way too much for babysitters.
Oh, come on. Really? Wow. Dark turn by Witten. Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. Well, this is Kier saying, thrown by a frog. Brilliant.
And this is Charles saying, I've learned the hard way, ain't I? We can go a long time without eating. I get a bit cranky with the old blood sugar level. Now, always come prepared.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.